Soul at Boyd's.
Hi there, I'm Akhila Rangana. As always, with me, Jeffrey Boycott, to answer all the questions that have come in for him. But before we start off today's Bowl at Boyd's, one quick question to Jeffrey. Jeffrey, the last time we had spoken, you had said that, you know, you didn't think that England would manage to win the Oval Test and regain the Ashes. But you also added that, you know, sport is a funny game and that, you know, we're often proven wrong. So this must be one of those few times when you're actually happy to have been proven wrong.
Yes, I'm very happy for England. What you'd never know about cricket is how much the toss influences a match on certain pitches. Normally in Test match cricket these days around the world, the pitches are pretty flat, probably except for a bit in India and mostly in Sri Lanka where it turns. Most of the pitches around are pretty flat for batting. The Oval wasn't like that, so it was very important who won the toss, and it was one of the old pitches that they used to get many, many years ago at the Oval that turned. And England got the better of it. So yes, I'm very pleased indeed.
Right, Jeffrey, we're going to start off today's show with a question that has come in from James from Leicester, and no surprises, it is related to the Ashes. Now, he makes an interesting observation. He says that in this Ashes, Australia had the top three wicket takers, and in the top five run getters in the series, four were Australians, yet they ended up on the losing side. So he wants to know, what were the key moments then that you felt, you know, swung the series in England's favour?
I think Cardiff was important, the first Test match. England were outplayed by Australia, and yet they couldn't bowl out England's tail-enders, number 10 and 11. They had nearly 12 overs. I accept it was a pretty flat pitch, started to turn a little at the end. But even so, when you've got nearly 12 overs to bowl out tail-enders, and you can't do that, I think that hurts you. And to come away with a draw there was euphoric for England, and quite disappointing for Australia. I mean, I didn't understand totally some of the selections of bowlers. I mean, we had North, who's a left-handed, very good batsman, bowling occasional off-spin at the tail-enders. Well, normally, the tail-enders have usually been the rabbits for the fast bowlers. You get the fast bowlers on, put a fear of God up them, and get them out. Now, Mitchell Johnson didn't bowl much at the tail-enders, so, you know, they've got to ask themselves questions. And then when England got out of jail, the series seesawed because I don't think there was much between the teams until the Oval. Now, normally the Oval can be flat. I thought, well, seamers would be the order of the day. And what happened? The groundsman, right or wrongly, made a turning pitch. It was overdry. It was all like a third day pitch. When the match started, it was almost as if it had 3 days. Then we had dry weather, sunny weather. Dried out more. It's one of the old pitches. And I think winning the toss there was absolutely priceless. And then using it quite well, that is getting 300, was pretty good. I mean, there's nothing in the laws of cricket that say what sort of surface has to be provided for a cricket match. I mean, there are too few quality spinners around in the world today. I think England made one mistake in that they picked Harmison, a fourth seamer. They should have picked a second spinner, whether it was Monty Panesar or Adil Rashid of Yorkshire, because it turned quite a lot, and it was always going to turn from the first morning. They were worried about Flintoff's knee, so they packed another seamer in, but until the last day when Harmison had a little aggressive spell and got a couple of wickets, he wasn't really in the game, which was not his fault, it was the pitch. And Australia made a huge mistake in not picking their one spinner, even if he's not a great spinner. I mean, any decent spinner bowling on there would have done well. Too many flat, easy batting pitches, and they've all got sucked into that and expecting a flat batting pitch like I did. In my opinion, let's have more turners, more spinning pitches. It makes for exciting cricket.
Right, Jeffrey, no surprises, we are rather Ashes heavy today. Now, when a series is lost, invariably questions are raised over the captaincy, and Nick from Sydney sends in a question related to Ricky Ponting's captaincy, and he asks, is Ponting's captaincy under threat after the Ashes defeat? He says he doesn't mind splitting the captaincy with Michael Clarke, but do Australia need a change in leadership at this point? What do you think, Jeffrey?
For me, leadership's always been two parts. One is leading the players, that having the man management skills or the personality to handle the players on the field, off the field. The other part of captaincy is tactical nous, knowing when to change the bowling, what side to pick, and having the feel for the game that you're two steps ahead of the game. I think Ricky Ponting is the right man at the moment. I still think he's the right man. He's got the personality, the leadership skills to handle the players. I think he's so much respected and so good a player that I think changing leadership at this point would be wrong, in my opinion. I think he's been a great ambassador for Australian cricket. I think when it comes to tactical nous, yes, I think he's pretty ordinary or average, just like Andrew Strauss is with England. They're not in the same category as a Brearley or a Close or an Illingworth.
Right, Geoffrey, moving on. Up next is a question from Kenny, who writes in from Leeds, and he wants to know, do you see potential in Stuart Broad to become a world-class all-rounder? What does he need to do if you think he can achieve that mantle?
Well, I do think he does have a lot of ability and a lot of potential. I think he's ambitious, which is nice, and I think he's got a good character and a nice brain on him. If he's going to become a proper all-rounder, it's going to be damn hard work now in international cricket for any all-rounder, because there's so much cricket, not only test cricket, but so many one-dayers of 20-20, 50-over variety, that where in the past, many years ago, you had all-rounders that they just got up for, say, five test matches in a summer. Now there's so much. So he's going to have to really look after himself, his body, his mind gets rested, his body stays fit. He's young enough to do it, but he can't afford poor bowling days. He just can't. I mean, he had a poorish day at Edgbaston in the third test where the ball seemed to float out of his hand. Then he had a decent day at Headingley where he got wickets. I wouldn't say he bowled great, but he bowled quite decently. And then at the Oval, he bowled fantastic. I mean, unbelievable. Cutting the ball off a dry surface, making it swing a little bit in the air or move a little bit. Now, you can have days when you bowl well and don't get wickets. But you can't really have days when you bowl badly. I think that's going to be the key, is consistency in his bowling. But he's young. He should get better. And batting, instead of batting now at the end of the innings with a few tail-enders around him and playing a few shots, and if he gets 30, 40, that's good. A 50 is excellent. Now he's going to move up the order and bat seven. And when he gets in, he's going to be batting with one of the batsmen. Either Pryor in front of him, could be batting with Peterson or Strauss getting a big 100. So there's the opportunity now to get bigger scores, and he will be under more pressure. So there'll be opportunities to score vital runs, and there'll be opportunities better to stay in and score bigger runs. I think he has the talent, actually. It'll be interesting to see how he develops.
Hi, Geoffrey. Another question related to the Ashes now. It's from Gareth, who writes in from Cardiff, and he wants to know, how would you compare the Ashes win in 2005 with this one, and which of the two England teams you think is the better one?
Well, in my opinion, it's no contest, 2005. I mean, in batting-wise, we had Trescothick, who was at his best. We had Vaughan in better form. Peterson played that fantastic innings at the Oval. I know he got dropped at slip by one, but that happens to all of us. But he still played a fantastic innings that created a draw when England could have lost. Where this series, he's had two tests and then been injured and nothing special in the two tests. I think the captaincy of Vaughan is far superior to almost anything around. He's certainly better than Andrew Strauss. I don't think it's a contest there of handling the players and the tactical know-how. And on top of that, the bowling of Flintoff, who was fully fit, he was at his zenith in 2005, very intimidating, very fast, very aggressive, could bowl swing and reverse swing around the wicket, and he caused a lot of problems to the left-handers. In fact, at times, he was awesome to the left-handers. This series, you know, there's been a lot about how they've had to nurse him through. One test he couldn't play, and I think Jones was a factor. Jones' first change, you know, was quite slippy, skiddy, swinging the ball at pace, and then Hoggard was at his best. For me, as thrilled as I am that England have done good and won, and it's good for our cricket, 2005, we hadn't won as well for 18 years, so, you know, that was a better team.
Right, Jeffrey, it's time now to step a little bit away from the Ashes and move on to a technical query that's coming from Mahmood, who writes in from Lahore. He says he's 16 and is a budding top-order batsman, and he says that when we are taught how to bat, we generally tend to stop at the basics, that's, you know, practicing defense and perfecting our foot movement, but we are never really taught how to play the big shots. So he wants to know, how does one make the transition from defense to power play while batting?
Well, simple. It comes back to practice. But again, it comes back to how you practice. Now, when you normally have some practice sessions, whether it's in the nets or just with fielders, usually batsmen go in and try to play properly, or just as if they were starting an innings in a match, and then they progress to playing one or two shots as they get used to the bowling and the practice pitch. But what you should do is halfway through your practice, say, right, to the bowler, we're going to play a game here. Tell me what field you would set for me if I was playing one day cricket and I was going to attack you. Ask him exactly where he would set his fielders. Then you try and memorize them. And then say, right, I'm going to try and score. I'm going to attack you just like one day cricket. So then you play as if you were playing in a match. You try things out. You invent shots. And that way you try things out. And try not to get out. That's important, because that's what you would want to do in a match. So you can't just willy-nilly just slug at the ball. You've got to look for areas where you think you can hit, and that's where you've got to do your practice. How do you think someone like Kevin Peterson, when he played the switch hit first in a match, and everybody were awed by it, he practices it in the nets, you know. It didn't just happen one day in the middle, and he just thought, oh, I'll have a little try at this. You have to make a kind of match. You have to prepare yourself and try it over and over again, different bowlers, and think about where you're going to hit them. And then you'll gain confidence as well as prepare yourself for that shot, so that when you play it in the middle, you'll feel that you have a pretty good idea of what you're trying to do and that you feel you have a pretty good chance of success.
Boyk's question of the week.
Well, Mahmood, hope that helps you out. Jeffrey, it's now time to move on to the question of the week, and it's related to someone who has been mentioned in the show. It's Andrew Flintoff. The question is from Jason, who writes in from California, and he wants to know, what will Flintoff's greatest legacy be now that he's retired from Test cricket? His overall record, Jason thinks, is modest, and he's still often described as England's greatest cricketer after Ian Botham. So is he really that great? Jason's asking. What do you think, Jeffrey?
Well, I don't think he's England's greatest cricketer after Ian Botham. I think he's probably England's best all-rounder since Botham. There's been a lot of other great cricketers, batsmen and bowlers. But look, no, in terms of wickets and runs, he isn't a great cricketer. And I think he would accept that because he has no ego. He's a smashing lad, down to earth. And the public and people who watch cricket, they empathise with him. It's because his personality and character, and he has that ability to lift people around him. That is, when he's in the dressing room or on the field, if he performs well, he has that gift, that charismatic gift to lift other people. And that's a very special quality that not too many people have. That will be his legacy as much as his runs or wickets.
Well, thanks for that, Jeffrey. That's a wrap on today's show. Don't forget, you can send in your questions to Jeffrey Boycott using our feedback form, and he'll be back here in a fortnight, all set to answer them. Until then, it's goodbye.
Bowl at Boyk's on Crick Info Talk.